I'm Dr. Leif Tapanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Hey, today's guest is Brett Hewitt. He's the Park and Rec's superintendent and arborist for the city of Pocatello. Guess what? We're talking about trees in the city. Peter.
You know, I think this is important. We just can't assume that we go to the store and pick our favorite looking tree. I mean, there's a thought process into how we select trees, not only within the city, but for our own personal private property.
Well, and we've talked with somebody from the university, I don't know, a number of episodes ago about the concept of the urban forest, that there's trees that are in the city and that they provide an ecological space for other organisms and how important that is. And, you know, it's obviously in our background and it's part of the nature that we live in day after day. And I think it's really important way for people to connect with the natural world that's just around us all the time. You don't have to get out of the city and go into the hills to observe nature. It's right around us all the time.
Yeah, and trees have their own little ecosystem right there.
Oh, those squirrels.
Oh, those squirrels.
Oh, them squirrels.
Yes.
Love them or hate them. I mostly love them. All right. Nature news first up.
So, Leif, we're going to talk about foul brood, which is a fatal bacterial infection.
Yeah, you got to say that.
Foul brood.
Foul brood sounds like a rock band or a
death metal band.
Yeah, I think
yeah
so.
Absolutely.
Grunge.
You know, one of those screaming death metal bands that you can't understand
foul
what
brood.
They're saying. Foul brood. So this is, it infects honeybees or the honeybee hives.
Okay.
So adult honeybees don't get sick from this bacterial infection, but what they do is they spread the spores throughout the hive, where the disease then infects and kills the larvae.
Oh.
And the really difficult part is the spores can remain viable for over 50 years. So
wow.
That means if foul brood gets into a hive, beekeepers basically have to destroy that hive.
Right.
But this is really kind of cool. We've got some researchers from Dalen Animal Health who have found a promising vaccine for foul brood. And while they were testing it out, they found out that this vaccine seems to be effective against a virus that's spread by mites. So with the honeybees, when the bees that have received the vaccine, the rate of larvae that die from foul brood is 2 times more than the vaccinated hives. So it's 50% effective. Then what they found as they were studying, they found a couple hives that had this virus in there from mites. And those that were vaccinated had an 83% less accumulation of the virus within the hives. So when you think about vaccinations, especially in the human end of it,
right,
and medicines, you know, bacterial infections and viral infections are different in our systems.
Sure. And we treat them differently,
and we
right?
treat them differently, but somehow, you know, honeybees might be slightly different.
If you vaccinate the bees. I have so many questions. How do you vaccinate a bee?
I absolutely knew you were going to ask that question, so I actually wrote this down so I could remember it.
Oh, good.
They use little tiny syringes, you know.
It's painless, I'm sure.
Yeah, 0.05 of a cc of vaccine, and they have to get it right there in their arm.
Oh my goodness.
What, I think they have 6 legs.
Which one do you pick?
Yeah, anyone.
Anyone?
Yeah.
Okay.
Actually, what they do is they've inoculated the a sugar paste, like basically candy, where the adult bees will eat the paste, and then it's incorporated into the worker bees anyway. It's incorporated into the royal jelly that the worker bees produce, which the queen eats, of course. And then it gets transported via a protein to the eggs, which then is now inoculated with the larvae.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you for this story. Okay. We have 2 band names now. We have Royal Jelly
and
Foul
Brood.
Yes. I love it.
Yes. Well, you remember green jelly way back when?
I do remember green jelly, green jello. Yeah.
Say that I do.
The little pigs or something.
Yeah.
Red song.
Yep.
All right. Well, today we're going to be talking trees. Our trivia question for today is all about trees. When was the first Arbor Day? I was surprised to learn this answer. Yeah. I think you will be too. When we come back from the break, Brett Hewitt joins us. We're going to be talking about trees in the city. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Here at NPR, we try to reach all kinds of listeners.
My name is Leo, and I'm 8 years old.
And we take feedback very seriously.
I never hear much about nature or dinosaurs or things like that.
So when Leo wrote us about our appalling lack of dinosaur coverage on All Things Considered, we knew we had to talk to him. Hi, Leo.
Hi.
I hear from your parents that you want to be a paleontologist when you grow up, and now we've got one on the line for you.
Okay.
Let me let you ask a question.
How did dinosaurs grow to be so big?
This is hard-hitting journalism because these are the types of questions that keep paleontologists up at night.
In public radio, we value our relationship with each and every one of our listeners. You listen to us, and we listen to you too. So keep our connection strong. Donate to this station right now. Here's how.
You know who covers dinosaurs really well? The Nature of Idaho on KISU. Support NPR and KISU programs by visiting KISU.org and click donate.
Hey, welcome back from the break. I want to welcome our guest today, Brett Hewitt. He's the Parks and Rec Superintendent and Arborist for the city of Pocatello. Welcome to Nature of Idaho.
Glad to be here.
Our first question is always, you know, tell us a little bit about yourself and tell us what an arborist does.
Okay, I've been with the city of Pocatello Parks and Recreation for going on 36 years now in various capacities. Certified arborist for the last 28 years. I've got, an arborist. I'll kind of give you a brief definition, I guess, of an arborist. Not everybody knows what it is. It's a professional in the practice of arboriculture, which is the cultivation, management, and maintenance of trees. To keep it simple.
Well, mm-hmm. So we've got a lot of trees in town. I can't imagine all of them are planted intentionally. Some of them kind of come in and were there already, and some of them are obviously planted and managed. So you've been doing this for quite some time. The city is, it's a pretty big city, and I can imagine, there's lots of trees you could choose, lots of trees that you didn't necessarily choose, and there's a kind of a change over time. So how managed is the city for trees? And I'm curious of how things have changed over time.
Well, I think what's really changed is different species becoming available, really. Back in the day when a lot of our mature trees around town are Siberian elm, some cottonwoods. That's probably what was available at that time. Blue spruce, ponderosa pine, that kind of stuff. Now they're tons of different kinds of trees within various species and everything, which you can really have a lot of variety.
Were the elm naturally here, or those were planted?
They weren't naturally here, I don't think. They were probably planted, and then they're just prolific.
Right, and long-lived. I think some of our largest, I live down by the university district, and there's a lot of big, old elms.
They grow real fast, and, that's what was available back in those days.
Sure.
We were talking a couple of weeks ago, Brett, because I work for the city as well in the same department, about you as an arborist, and you've got 20 plus years of experience. There are arborist classes and you can be certified, but the one thing that really stuck out is that with your experience, being able to look at bark, say, and say, here's the tree. I can go and take the arborist class and pass. But, I know what an elm looks like, and I know what a cottonwood looks like. I know what a spruce looks like. I go back, way back as an undergrad, I'm taking a field ecology class, and there's different types of spruce. And my faculty goes, well, if you grab a spruce by the needles and just say, ouch, that kind of hurts, then that's a spruce and other types of spruce. But if you grab a blue spruce branch on the needles and you throw an explicative before you say, ouch, then that's a blue spruce. And so you've got all kinds of experience. It's just not something that all of a sudden you go, hey, I'm an arborist. Right. It takes time.
It does take time. And like Peter said, you could theoretically pass the arborist exam and become a certified arborist and without a ton of knowledge, just studying from a book. Interestingly enough, on those conifers, though, conifers are pretty easy to tell apart. You can just by the needles. Pine trees, the needles are in clusters. You pull it off and there's a 3, 4, or 5 needle pines. a spruce tree, you pull a needle off, snap it in half, and it's a diamond shaped. And if you pull a fir tree off, snap it in half, it's oval. It won't tell you exactly what, you know, what kind it is, you know, variety wise, as far as that goes, but you can tell a.
But you're in at least in the right species.
Species or fir from a spruce and pine.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of some of the really charismatic trees that we have in town, or the big ones, the big old ones. We mentioned elm as being one of the long lived. I see a fair amount, depending where we are in town, cottonwood, mm-hmm. Large cottonwood. And some of them are getting to the age, you know, it's hard to know exactly how old they are, but they're really, really big and really tall. And some of them are starting to get to that age where maybe they're at their life expectancy. I don't, what's the general lifespan of some of these larger species?
The poplar along South Second and Ross Park, for example, I've got pictures somewhere that date them back to the 20s.
Okay.
They were pretty small then, so you're looking 100 years, which is getting close to the lifespan. If you've been through there, we're systematically taking those out as needed.
Yeah, and as they get bigger, the not just being big, but as they grow, they're kind of brittle wood, and they tend to lose limbs anytime there's any heavy snow or wind. Mm-hmm. They kind of shed a lot and become a bit of a maintenance issue.
Yeah, maintenance issue and safety issue.
Are they more sensitive to disease as well?
Yeah, the poplars start out disease prone, and there's several different pathogens that can get in there and cause havoc with those. And like I said, they take a ton of water, so any kind of drought conditions are going to take their toll on poplars.
So when we look at kind of ages of trees, I'm going to go back to an oak. If you plant an oak tree, it tends to be a slower growing tree, but lives for a long time.
300 plus years.
So can we kind of have a general rule that quicker growing trees last less time?
I think so. There are some trees that grow fast that are, you know, worth having around. Your honey locust grows fast. Actually, your oak, there are some varieties of oak that grow fast when they're young and then kind of harden off and grow a little slower as they go. They're really starting to take hold as far as being planted more and more often. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of varieties of oak that do quite well around here in our alkaline soil.
So when we're looking at trees, and we'll go from the city end and the park and rec, how do you decide what trees we'll put in our parks?
You know, years ago, our Pocatello Tree Commission, there was 10 or 12 of us on it at the time. We kind of went through and had some local experts, and I helped. I'm not going to consider myself a local expert, but I was in on that, and we went through and made an entire brochure list of trees, broke them down in sizes, whether or not they were street tree or native. We did make a notation whether they were native or what. Some people really like that. But we have a whole list of that on our city website, or we have a hard brochure that people can access, and it's actually a pretty all-inclusive list.
Yeah, I know the brochure you're speaking of. Mm-hmm. I have it at home, I peruse it every once in a while want to identify some plant that's in the neighborhood.
Right. We spent a lot of time on that, and something
beautiful.
We're pretty proud of. It turned out pretty good.
Yeah, I have it saved it on my computer with the PDF. So, no, I mean, it is a great
brochure.
That's
available just for listeners if they want to find it. That's on the City of Pocatello website.
You can find it on the list on the website. It doesn't have the colored pictures, I don't think.
Yeah, I think it's helpful to see it because, as you were saying, I think earlier, there's, you know, these days there's quite a variety of plants that are available to folks if they're buying it wherever they get their, you know, trees and that kind of thing. So coming back to Peter's question, so you have a park. What are good trees for, you know, a park setting that are good for, I guess the considerations are maintenance, there's growth, and I don't know what else goes into it.
Taking that list in mind, everybody's going to have favorite trees.
Sure.
You know, I have mine. I think, you know, we talked about the oaks already. They're really starting to become popular. A good, sturdy tree that doesn't, not a lot of natural disease that gets into them. You know, your lindens, your maples. Lindens are a little overplanted. You know, all of a sudden they really became popular.
We got
up,
lots
up and down
yep.
Satterfield Drive. You know, they're all up there. And they're a nice tree, but just too awful lot of them. Maples. You know, if you've got room to plant these larger species, honey locusts, those kind, you know, and then there's all kinds of class one, smaller power line friendly trees. If you've got a confined space, you want to, you know, your flowering crabs and choke cherry, that kind of stuff. But there's quite a list of those as well.
So do we run a risk, you know, as you talk about the lindens, do we run a risk if we plant too many of the same type of tree.
Yes, you do, especially on a lined boulevard, I guess, like that, where, you know, it's kind of a landscaping no-no to plant that many in a row like that. Because if you did have something, you know, disease come in and get them, you know, you'd just be devastated. So it'd be nice to alternate some of those, you know, keep from having one species on a in a neighborhood like that.
Are there trees where, you know, you would really recommend or hope that homeowners don't plant anymore?
I would think in town, any kind of poplar, cottonwood, no matter how you, whatever you want to call them, they're fast growing, weak wooded, disease prone trees that take an excessive amount of water in a high plain desert here like we are in Southeast Idaho.
Yeah, I was going to say, the great part about the pamphlet that you've put together is you do have the water usage of each tree species, and that's what I go straight to, how much water is being used. We are in a high plains desert. Use the ones that would work best here.
How are spruces? I recall blue spruce is somewhat a challenging. They're beautiful. They have a nice color. They can get quite large and live, my understanding, pretty long.
Yes, they can.
But
if you... You know, I know this has been a popular topic the last year. We've really lost, actually for several years, but last year in particular was really the spruce took a beating. You know, I attribute it to the, you know, in the fall of 22, we had that extended heat stretch after Labor Day. Even we were upper 90s for a week or two, I want to say. And then we went in and had a long, drawn out winter, cold, ground was froze. By the time the ground froze, the roots were unable to take in some of those nutrients early in the spring, and I think that contributed a lot of that. And then you get pests that come in. These trees are already stressed. The pests come in and take them out.
Yeah, so pests for spruce in particular, beetles?
There is an Ips beetle that takes some of them down. There are some needle casts that can take them out, which is an airborne fungus, which can be, like I talked about earlier, you know, we tend to plant those spruce in clusters of groups of three oftentimes, and that can be detrimental to creating more of a fungus, you know, where the moisture just sits inside those and doesn't have a chance to escape.
Yeah, I think when I moved here from Duluth, we were put in a quarantine, and the emerald ash beetle was moving into our region, and the city and the region was put into a quarantine. We want to do everything not to go into a quarantine like that. And, you know, you couldn't even bring wood. You had to buy wood if you were camping for a fire at the campground. Everyone was just ready for all the ashes to disappear. Are we facing a potential, I mean, do we have any with the pine beetles coming in or anything? Are we looking at anything of that nature?
You know, I don't think that there are still a lot of healthy spruce trees around, and still they're still pretty popular tree to plant, especially as far as conifers go. Not a big fan in a residential area, just because I don't think there's room for them. To me, a spruce tree should have the branches all the way to the ground, and what you see is people trim them up so you can get underneath them, which then the branches start sagging, and they're not that full, beautiful look like I think they should look. So I just don't think most yards are just not adequate space for them, in my opinion, but they're still, you see people plant them near their house all the time.
We had, and I mean, it was just the nature of the house. It was one of those big, magnificent, you know, 100-plus-year-old blue spruces. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it was planted, but I had to prune the branches up because you couldn't get to the house if you didn't.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, when they're small, right, you plant them right. What you think is the right distance from the house, not thinking they're never going to get bigger.
Exactly. And, you know, and we trim them up in the parks typically just because of the people, kids, vagrants can get underneath them and set up shop and do things they're not supposed to be doing, that kind of stuff. So we end up trimming them up as well, maintaining underneath them a little bit too.
While we're on conifers, what's your opinion on juniper in general? I know defensible space around houses, especially up in the hills, that juniper can be an issue. How about in the rest of the city?
You know, I think juniper. I like the upright ones, the ground cover tam junipers and such. Not a big fan of. I just think they outgrow their space, and if you can keep them maintained continually, they're not too bad, but it seems like they get overgrown, and then you end up heading them back to a point where that vegetation's just not going to grow on the end of it. You know, it's just going to look barren.
And, yeah.
So I would say, in my opinion, avoid that kind of stuff unless you're going to properly maintain them.
Yeah. In terms of water tolerance, they're nice, low.
Yeah, they're low water. They're tough. I mean, and the upright ones can be quite beautiful. I think they get a bad rap, but I kind of like them, actually.
Yeah, and I think it's just a matter of, you know, keeping their numbers controlled, you know, where so they're not. They remind me of, you know, from Iowa, and then even Brett grew up in Oklahoma, and I spent 10 years in Oklahoma. Red cedar was a problem everywhere because they can grow in horrible conditions, and then they just take over. And that's the problem when there's too many of them. And I think if we can just kind of, like you say, build the defensible space around your house and make sure that if you have five, it doesn't turn into 50. You know, that's the problem, right?
I don't think junipers spread quite like red cedar.
No, cedar was tough.
Yeah.
And just for the listeners, the foothills around here, those are junipers, not cedars, despite what you'll hear.
Right. Everything, the old street names or geographic names always have cedar written in them. It's
the
like, apartment, nope.
The condos out the by cedars, Riverside Golf Course. Yeah.
No, junipers. Okay, so what's your opinion on fruit trees? I mean, we like fruit. The fruit can be gleaned off of them. That's great. Sometimes they can be a mess as well in the fall.
I think, you know, they're worthwhile trees if you don't mind the mess. I had a couple apple trees at my first house I owned, and I finally ended up taking them down. I kind of trimmed them back to the point where I thought the fruit production would be less. I tried spraying them at the proper time, and nothing really helped, so I ended up taking them out. But if you don't mind the fruit, or if you've got an orchard or something that you don't mind, you know, the fruit can drop and you don't have to pick up, you can just let them
go too,
into the soil. They're fine. I mean, like I said, I like apples. Everybody likes apples and peaches. And
I think there's some varieties of self-pollinating apple trees. So that's always good, because if you don't have that, to get apples, you have to have at least two trees near each other. So
yeah, I think they will. Yeah, they will usually find a way to make fruit. But there are plenty of varieties of flowering, fruitless type crab apple trees, choke cherry, that kind of stuff. So I think your options are limitless on some of them. Color of flower, you know, you got pink flower, red flower, white flowers, all kinds of different stuff like that now.
And it helps with our local pollinators as well. So
yes,
if you want to grab a flowering, non-fruit producing tree, fantastic.
So what are we looking at in the future? What's our forecast in the city? Has there been a change in thought of how many trees to put in? Is there sort of a management plan in terms of we'd like to see more varieties? You mentioned Linden.
I think variety is a good point you bring up. I mean, I think everybody seems to still want to plant, you know, your maples, Lindens, honey locusts, which are fine trees. It just I would encourage people, if you get a chance, to maybe go to one of your local nurseries and pick out a tree that maybe you're not that familiar with, learn a little bit about it and plant that. So moving forward, we have a little bit more diversity in our urban forest.
And I get it, you know, like a linden, a full-grown linden is absolutely a beautiful tree. And we all want that tree, but sometimes this kind of like me. Find the less handsome tree and plant that instead, right?
The less handsome tree.
Yeah.
What's the less handsome tree? What would you recommend?
An elm? No.
Heavens no.
Or an elm or a Russian olive. Okay, so don't listen to me on that part. Stay away from those two trees.
You mentioned. Okay, so talk about Russian olives.
You know, there was a lot of them in the parks when I first started working here. They've kind of we've lost a lot of them. They've died. A lot of them have tipped over. They have a real shallow root system, and you know, in an urban setting, and can tip over often. They are great squirrel habitat. Birds love them.
Right. But, lots of fruit come off of them.
Yeah,
right.
I think,
and they smell nice.
And the nice thing about them, I think my old predecessor Wayne Rickard, you know, he said they break up the landscape. They're different. You know, they're that lighter that. Olive color green, you know,
right.
So they're not the same as most of the other trees in the summer. So that's kind of a neat, interesting thing about them too. But I think they're better choices out there nowadays.
Sure.
I would agree. And, you know, when you have to trim up one of their branches, they've got little pokey things that they're not so looky. You know, I don't hardly ever wear gloves. And the first time I tried to prune up a Russian olive, I decided that leather gloves are important.
Necessary.
What's the time of year to plant trees? Is there a best time of year?
Now's a great time. Until the heat of the summer, really.
Early spring?
Yeah, I think now, you know, as soon as the ground thaws good enough to dig a hole in the spring, you can plant trees. You know, they'll be a little bit dormant. I think as the heat comes on, I would avoid planting larger trees. You know, if you got smaller trees, you can probably still get away with it where you can keep them wet. And then in the fall.
The
fall is a great time to plant. Your soil temperatures are really warm.
Okay.
They can really establish.
And they can establish before the ground freezes up.
The thing I would encourage people to do in the fall, though, is continue watering them.
Yeah.
Even after you blow your sprinkler systems out or you stop thinking about watering other things. If you plant a new tree in the fall, continue to water it till the ground freezes, really.
Okay.
So correct me. I swear I've read some articles where when you water that much, that actually helps protect the roots after it freezes, right?
If it's freezing outside, obviously you don't want to freeze them roots, but moist soil will insulate that to some degree.
We started our show with a trivia question on Arbor Day. And when was the first Arbor Day in the United States?
The first Arbor Day was April 10th, 1872.
1872.
And as we were talking about this, where was it?
I was in Nebraska, believe it or not. I don't know if anybody's ever drove through Nebraska. It seems like an odd place to start.
Maybe they needed some trees. There's
a lot of grass, a lot of short grass prairie, not many trees, but there you go.
I shouldn't say too much about that. I grew up in the panhandle of Oklahoma, and there was, you know, plenty of room for trees out there as well.
Well, in Iowa, if there wasn't all the farms, the only trees you'd see were along the rivers. So. Awesome, Brett, and thank you for joining us today to find out more about our trees, especially that the tree pamphlet that you helped put together. If you just go to the city webpage and click on the Park and Rec Department, you should be able to find that pamphlet and encourage everyone to use it because it is fantastic.
The Nature of Idaho receives support from listener contributions to KISU-FM. Shows are produced at KISU Studios in Pocatello at Idaho State University with editing and production by Jody Schwicht. Music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. Audio of this and all past episodes of The Nature of Idaho can be found at KISU.org or from Spotify and other select podcast services. Send your thoughts and suggestions to NOID KISU@ISU.edu.